From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, the legacy of China's one-child policy. In 1979, in response to what was said to be an impending demographic crisis, China imposed the most drastic population control law the world had ever seen. It was a mandate that each family was entitled to only one child.
Promoted via propaganda posters, the communist government claimed its one-child policy prevented 400 million births and lifted many out of poverty.
In October 2015, China announced it was officially ending the one-child policy. And in the years since, the Chinese government has made an effort to go in the opposite direction entirely. That is, to incentivize having more children, even penalizing those who don't have a second child. That's because the one-child policy so dramatically changed the demographics of China that the country is now dangerously aging. The number of men of childbearing age far outstripped the number of women, and the birth rate remains low. Further, with the cost of raising children rising, many families don't want more than one child.
We found even with the rule change, the dream of a second child is not universal.
The filmmaker Nanfu Wang grew up in rural China. When she became a mother herself, she began to wonder about the continued impact of the one-child policy. In her new documentary, One Child Nation, she explores the legacy of the policy, both in her own family and across the country.
I never thought much about what the policy meant for me or anyone until I learned that I was going to be a mom. I wondered if most people in China really thought it was worth the sacrifices each family made. Hello?
Hi, is this Nanfu?
Yes.
Hi, Nanfu, it's Sarah Wildman. How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So I just want to start with asking about the year you were born.
I was born in 1985. It was 6 years after China initiated the one-child policy.
And for our listeners, can you tell us how the one-child policy first came about?
It was really initiated with the goal of controlling the population. The government set a rule of controlling reproductive rights and limiting every family to have only one child. And that was in responding to the starvation that China had during the Great Leap Forward, and also the ambition China had to become one of the greatest economic power within decades.
So the year you were born, 1985, the one-child policy was in full swing.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about your name, Nanfu. It's not a typical girl's name.
My name is Nanfu, and in Chinese, Nan is the character that means male, and Fu means pillar. Usually it's used as the pillar of the house, the pillar of the country. And my family chose that name in the hope that they would get a boy. And when I turned out to be a girl, they decided that they were going to name me Nanfu anyway. And my father had told me that you are going to grow up as strong as a man and to be like the pillar of the house of the country.
But actually, the village leaders did want to sterilize your mother after your birth, didn't they?
Yeah. So in China, I don't know the statistics, but during the generations of the one-child policy, women are forced to be sterilized. And in my region, because it's a rural area and my parents didn't have official jobs, so when the official wanted to sterilize my mom, there was a lot of resistance from my grandfather who wanted to have a grandchild. And if he didn't have a grandchild, it could mean that our family goes extinct. Like the last, our last name, our family, that there is no male offspring to carry it on. So eventually the local officials allowed my mom to have a second child, but she had to wait for 5 years, and our family had to pay a substantial fine. And that actually was common during the early 1980s in poor rural areas.
Can you describe the town you're from? What's it called? What does it look like?
I was born and I grew up in a very small farming village. It's called Wangjiazhou. Literally translation would be Wang's village, because the entire village, under 2,000 people, they all share the same last name, Wang, W-A-N-G. And the highest education in my village is elementary school. So everyone who lived in the village, after they finish their elementary school, they either choose to go work in the city, or if they have the opportunity to study, they would have to go away and study in the middle school in the city, which was what I did.
And you describe in your film that you were almost embarrassed that you actually had a brother.
Yes. When I went to the middle school in the city, I realized that everyone around me came from the one-child family, because in urban areas, families are not allowed to have a second child, unlike the rural areas where parents do not have a job. They could risk of losing their job. So all my classmates, they were the only child, and I was probably the only one that had a sibling. And when my classmates find out that, they usually would laugh at me or joked that my family is from the rural area and is poor, is backwards, is uneducated. And at some point, I just stopped like telling people that I had a younger brother, and I would feel like if I met a stranger, I would choose not to bring it up until absolutely that it was like discovered by people. And once people discovered it, I often felt a sense of shame and embarrassment. And it was something that I never thought why I should feel embarrassed about, like what I'm ashamed of, until now, until when I was making the film and I started thinking about my own experience with the one-child policy, and I realized the shame and embarrassment was so subconscious and deeply rooted because of the propaganda messages around me that told me that one child is the best. Anyone who has more than one child is selfish, is taking up the resources that is supposed to be someone else, is making the whole universe, the whole planet, like overcrowded. And all those messages became my own. I internalized that kind of shame and embarrassment. And when I was showing the film now, and sometimes I would meet audience who also came from China and who also had siblings and who shared with me that they have had the same feelings. One person told me when she came to the US and for the first time she saw her friends, people who have siblings, and they realized that this is a normal thing. While like the whole time, her whole life, she felt she was abnormal. And rationally, she understood that everyone now like normally could have siblings, but emotionally, it still take her a long time to reconcile with the negative feelings that she had associated with siblings.
Can you describe some of the messages that were painted on walls or sung about in operas or put on matchbooks that you show in the film?
Yeah, I think one of the most common one would be one child is the best, which now you look at it is so simple, but when it's everywhere, it just became normalized. It's like the wall that's always been there, a tree that's always been there, like the air, the water, that at some point you just stop questioning the legitimacy or whose message is this. You just took it for granted that this is just what the norm is, what the society, what the world should be. Like if you dared to have a second child, your whole family would end up in prison. Or if you hide your pregnancy, you can hide today, but you can never escape tomorrow. Like all those slogans are painted all over the place.
You began this project because you yourself had just become a mother.
Yes. When I found out I was pregnant, during the first few weeks, I realized how protective I suddenly became. The world suddenly became very dangerous to me. Like I'm noticing all the dangers, both current and imagining in the future, and all the issues that suddenly became, you know, relevant to my son's future. And I found myself thinking, like, if I lived suddenly, like because of the pregnancy, lived so much consciously aware of the danger around me, what would the women and children do who lived under the one-child policy, who did not have any control over their own safety, who lived under the fear almost every day, not knowing whether the woman can keep the child or whether the child can be born, or whether when the child is born, they can keep them or not. So it was then I started having a lot of questions. And I asked my mom what her experience was when she was pregnant with me, what she witnessed. And the stories that she told me made me realize I really hadn't thought about the one-child policy or looked at it the way that I should.
What was one story she told you that really made you start to change your perspective?
She described how one of her neighbors who had two daughters and really wanted a son, and how when she was pregnant with a third, the local officials kidnapped her, tied her up, and beat her and took down her house, and how she almost went insane, like mentally ill after the loss of her child, and how decades later, all the time, she was ashamed, ostracized by the community because her family didn't have a male offspring, and she, as a woman in a patriarchal society where a lot of her value, the society believed, relies in her reproductive value. So like story like that, my mom told me, and of course, the story that she helped my uncle to leave his daughter when she was only an infant, several days old, in the market and left her to die there. All those stories that I think I never heard in such detail and thought it that way until now I was a mom and I was listening to story from the perspective of a mom and just found it inconceivable. And I had many more questions that I felt I needed to find the answer and I wanted to ask and I wanted to know what exactly happened and why it happened, why so many people were on board with this policy if it was so brutal.
You interviewed your uncle who, as you just described, abandoned his infant daughter in a market and she dies. She's not adopted by anyone. How did he receive you? How was it for him to talk to you?
My uncle and I always had a great relationship because I was the daughter of my mom, who is his elder sister. So I was actually the first child of the next generation. So when my uncle was young, I was the only child and he loved me. And to me, he was always this like authority figure that I like him, but also I'm intimidated by him. He's a big guy. And when I was making the film, I wanted to talk to him about this because my mom had already told me the story. And I wanted to hear from him, how could you do this as a parent? And I would see him several times when he came to our house, but I never had the courage to request an interview. We never talked like any serious matters like that. And it was like also cross-generation, like the adults do not talk to me like their personal issues. And I also knew the fact that since his daughter died, he had not talked about that for the past 20 years. So it took me a long time to master the courage. So when I eventually talked to him, I could see the pain on his face when he described it. And when I asked him, how could you do it? He told me the story how his mom threatened to commit suicide if he was going to keep the infant daughter. And it was then I understood him. If I went in his position, I wouldn't know what I would choose if my mom would threaten to commit suicide. And he really believed she would do that. And I really don't think that my uncle had a choice at the time.
It's not just your uncle, though. It's also your aunt who gives up a child.
Yeah, my aunt is on my father's side, my father's sister, and my uncle is my mom's younger brother. And my aunt also gave away her daughter. And instead of leaving her daughter in the market, she thought the best way for her is to give her away to a human trafficker and hoping that this human trafficker could take her daughter and send her to a family who would allow her to survive.
Both of those were girl babies, was that
yes.
correct?
Yes.
And did both of those people go on to have other children?
Yes, my uncle and both did that to giving away a daughter, because under the one child policy, when you only had one chance of having one child, or in rural areas sometimes two, they would give away the daughter hoping that the next one would be a boy.
Tell me about visiting the midwife from your village. She was actually the midwife who helped your own birth.
Yes, she is 84 years old, and I went to see her, and I thought I was going to ask her some easy questions to warm up. And the first question I started was, hey, do you remember how many babies you delivered throughout your entire career? And she said, I don't remember that number, but I do remember I did 50,000 abortions and sterilizations. And that was not I expected to hear. She said it almost as a matter-of-fact way, and then revealed to me how guilty and traumatized she was when she performed all those forced abortions and sterilizations. And sometimes a late-term baby would be born alive, and she would kill the baby alive. And she's been spending the past years trying to atone her sin. And that moment, I realized all those people, including the ones who are the enforcers of the policy, they are also the victims of the policy. They experience the trauma just as much as the victims who suffered the abortions and sterilizations did.
Each person that you meet, from the village official in your town to the midwife to the high-ranking Chinese official, even your mother, everyone says they had no choice.
Yes, the film, to some point, is about choice, about the lack of choice, about what would happen when the government takes away women's reproductive choice, and what would happen when the government takes away any individual's choice in general. And that's how the people felt. The women could not choose how many children they could have, when they could have a child. And every individual felt like, in front of this top-down government, in front of this national policy, and the powerful, you know, police, law enforcement, they didn't have any other option rather than obey the policy.
Three quarters of the way through the film, though, you turn your focus to the human trafficking aspect of this, which is away from the abortions and sterilizations. You meet a couple in Utah, of all places, who begin to look into the many thousands of girls who were sent abroad. Can you tell me a bit about them?
This couple, they are Brian Stai and Longlan Stai. Longlan, she is a Chinese woman, and she met her American husband, and they together have three adopted daughters from China. And at the very beginning, they, like any other adopted parent, they just love their daughter, believed in their stories, and tried to take them back to travel to China. But one time, when Longlan went to China and tried to visit the person who the orphanage said had found one of their daughters, because she speaks Chinese and because she was able to talk to that person, she got the woman to tell her that actually they all made it up. None of the documents were true. They were all fabricated. The story was fabricated. The daughter was not found where they said that they found her. And that motivated the couple to do the research. First, for their own daughter, they went all over China to the orphanages. And then what they found was astonishing, that really high percentage of all the adoptees, their stories were fabricated. And once they collect all the information, they realize that they kept investigating. And what they found out is the corruption is almost nationwide.
And the majority of girls, you actually spoke to one of the traffickers who had been imprisoned, but he describes finding girls along the road who'd been abandoned.
So that's one way. So the trafficker in the film, his name is Duan, but also my aunt gave her daughter away to a trafficker. So in China, actually, in a lot of places, regions, local places, they have this kind of a human trafficker. In my village, we would call the human trafficker matchmaker. So these people, they work for the state-owned orphanage. In China, in the early 1990s, they started the international adoption program. So there were a lot of state-owned orphanage that help foreign families to adopt Chinese children. And because of the demand for the babies, the orphanages would then hire farmers, people who live in poverty, to offer them a job. We'll say, if you bring an infant into the orphanage, you get paid $50, something like this. So in a lot of regions, there were people who do this as a living. And the trafficker that we found, Duan, he and five other people did this for years. And eventually, when the scandal was broken that there were fabricated story in the orphanages, Duan and his family were sentenced to 10 to 20 years, while the state orphanage did not have responsibility.
The one-child policy was ended about 4 years ago now, 4 years ago this fall, and it has slowly, the Chinese government has changed not only restriction, but has now begun to promote two children or more in some regions, but it doesn't seem to be working. Why do you think?
I think after almost four decades of indoctrination and everyday promotion of the message that one child is the best, a lot of the people who grew up under the policy, who was born when the policy was already in place, so there wasn't a day of their life that they never thought that one child wasn't the best. So at this point, when the government realized that there is a lack of a workforce and try to encourage people to have more children, a lot of young people actually chose to just have one child. And the government is using all sorts of incentives and sometimes even forcing people to have more children now.
You now live in the United States.
Yeah, I live in the U.S. now.
And in the U.S., we have a different battle going on over the right to abortion in a number of states across the country. How do you see the two parallels between our countries? The question of the United States and the fight for women's right to control their bodies here versus in China?
I think both are examples of how a government or governments try to take away the reproductive choice, try to control women's reproductive rights, whether it's the state forced abortion or states limited the access to abortion. They are similar things, which is not allowing women to make their own choice.
How did your perspective on the one-child policy evolve over the course of making this film?
Well, I think during the making of the film, it really made me realize how pervasive propaganda is and how powerful it can be and how damaging it could be if one doesn't recognize the messages around them and to really distinguish propaganda from the truth and not mistake propaganda as the truth.
There's a palpable sadness among many of the people that you speak to, including your own brother.
Yeah, my brother told me how guilty he felt when our family decided that he should be the one to continue school and I should work and support him. And I think he had always felt guilty about it. But this time on camera was the first time he had the chance to say it aloud. And I was deeply touched by what he said. We always have great relationship. We are best of friends. And so when he said that to me and he was almost crying and I was crying too, because it was hard to and moving. And he said, I didn't know what to do. I thought it was not fair, but I had no choice. I had no control. That's what I'm saying, like, in a society that every individual doesn't feel like they don't have a choice in front of the social power, the authority. That's what really, like, made me sad.
You say towards the end of the film that you fear the memory of the one-child policy is fading, but there's so many fewer women than there would have been. It doesn't look like the reversal of the policy will change that demographic slide.
When I talked about memory, it's because I feel a nation's identity is so much dependent on the nation's memory. For example, a lot of our generations growing up never heard of a Tiananmen Square protest. A lot of the younger generations or our generation never even heard of a Great Leap Forward. And fewer younger people than me really knew the Cultural Revolution. So all of those things have been erased or revised in the history by the authority. There is just one official narrative now is the official history of China within China. And I've witnessed how things like that could be forgotten or not known by general Chinese public because the people who have lived through it either have died or are imprisoned or are in exile. And when the one-child policy ended, I was witnessing similar things that all the media coverage is celebratory, talking about how great the one-child policy contributed to the economy, how great a national policy it had been for the past 4 decades. And the people who lived it, they are going to die. The propaganda going to be erased. In 5 years or 10 years, you probably can't find the original propaganda existed anymore because they're all replaced by the now new propaganda promoting two-child as the best. So I hope that the film can serve as a true record of what the one-child policy really is for the people who lived through it.
Can you describe any of the new propaganda? I know there are new signs on the walls. What do they now say?
In the past, it says one child is the best. You get all the resources to yourself. And now it's like two child is the best. You would always have a sibling that you can talk to or something. Or two child is the best. When the kids are little, they would have a company. When they are old, when you are old, you could have support. So if you compare the one child policy and the two child policy propaganda messages, a lot of them are really contradictory because they just switch subtle changes of the language. So it's very ironic to see them side by side.
I'm curious about one other thing. Your aunt takes a DNA sample, a spit sample like people do for Ancestry.com or 23andMe, in search of the girl that she gave up at 20 days old. Does she harbor hope still that she'll meet her?
I think she does. Yeah, she's hoping that one day she would reconnect with her daughter, although we don't know where her daughter is now and even whether she survived or not.
Nanfu, thank you so much again for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Nanfu Wang. Her new film is One Child Nation. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with Benjamin Soloway and Maya Gandhi. Our editor is Rom Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you liked this episode, please subscribe. We'll be back next Friday. Thanks for listening.